from KQED. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Coming up on Forum, at its peak, Theranos, the blood testing device company led by the charismatic Elizabeth Holmes, was valued at $9 billion, with investors pouring hundreds of millions into the startup. Then, in 2015, came John Carreyrou's piece in the Wall Street Journal that the company was selling a story. In reality, Theranos' technology barely worked. Carreyrou joins Forum to talk about how he uncovered the company's deception and the lessons Silicon Valley should learn from it. Join us after this news. Welcome to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. The Silicon Valley company Theranos promised to transform the process of blood testing with devices that could run many tests quickly using just droplets of blood. That was revealed to be a falsehood, propelled by the charms of its enigmatic founder, Elizabeth Holmes, but one that would draw in hundreds of millions of dollars from investors and companies like Walgreens using the technology on consumers. In October 2015, when Theranos' glow was still blinding, Wall Street Journal investigative reporter John Carreyrou wrote a stunning piece exposing deceptive practices at Theranos. It's now a book titled Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup, and he joins us now to talk about it. Welcome to Forum, John Carreyrou.
Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks for being here. Okay, so just to start, what did Theranos promise its devices could deliver? What was the technology? How different was it from how we do blood testing now?
Well, the promise was that it could do the full range of lab tests. And if you speak to lab experts, that's anywhere from several hundred to several thousand blood tests, from just a drop or two of blood pricked from a finger, that the test results would be back very quickly in a matter of hours, and that the tests would be offered at a fraction of the prices that the rest of the lab industry offers tests for. And so, you know, it would have been a game-changing technology, because no one up until then had figured out how to run so many tests off such a small sample of blood.
And the sample of blood would be basically pumped into a cartridge that would go into a machine?
Theranos had a little sample collection device, and then transferred the blood to these tiny tubes that it called nanotainers, and then the nanotainers slotted into a cartridge. The cartridge slotted into a device, and the test results would be beamed wirelessly from the device to a computer at Theranos, and then interpreted by the computer. And the result would be so it sounded very whiz bang and computerized and sophisticated.
And talk about why companies like Walgreens and Safeway, well known companies here, would be really interested in this technology. Like what did it mean for everyday people like you and me, and for their business model?
Yeah, but both Walgreens and Safeway were really taken in by the promise of these finger stick tests. They felt that it could open up a big new revenue stream for them, not just in terms of bringing in more foot traffic in their stores, but actually by sharing in the revenue of offering these Theranos finger stick tests in little blood draw centers in their stores. And so Elizabeth Holmes, the founder of Theranos, approached both of these companies in early 2010 and told them, you know, she had invented this technology and negotiated partnerships with each of them. Safeway would have the exclusive right to offering the tests in the supermarket market and Walgreens in the drugstore market. And eventually the Safeway partnership unraveled before they went live in Safeway stores, but the Walgreens partnership did not. And Theranos actually did go live with its finger stick tests in Walgreens stores in Northern California and in Arizona.
And this was not before Safeway, for example, invested how much in it? Well, or at least in creating places in their stores where...
Right. Safeway lent Theranos $30 million and on top of that spent about $350 million renovating half of its supermarkets to accommodate these upscale clinics in which patients would come get their fingers pricked and get these test results all for nothing. I mean, that money, which was wasted, went down the drain. Walgreens itself invested $140 million. They paid Theranos a $100 million innovation fee and lent the company another $40 million.
Wow. Well, and describe quickly why pharmaceutical companies were also so interested in this technology.
Right. So when Elizabeth founded Theranos in 2003, the business model originally was to offer these fingerstick tests to pharmaceutical companies and so that they could use them in clinical trials. And the idea was that the Theranos devices would be put in patients' homes who were enrolled in clinical trials and that they would prick their fingers several times a day. The blood test results would be beamed to the pharmaceutical clinical trial sponsor, and it would enable pharmaceutical companies to change the dosage during the clinical trial if they saw, you know, say, adverse reactions. And Elizabeth touted her technology as a way for pharmaceutical companies to save billions of dollars on clinical trial research. The problem was that none of these she negotiated pilots with several of these pharmaceutical companies, and none of these validation studies actually showed the Theranos technology to work. So one by one, these pharmaceutical deals fizzled out. And by 2010, she had sort of exhausted that avenue because, you know, they all walked away from her. And that's when she pivoted to a direct-to-consumer model via Walgreens.
And just to give our listeners a sense of how she was able to dupe companies, you can describe how she, you know, presented the technology to pharmaceutical companies or even to places like a Walgreens or Safeway that made them believe that it worked.
Right. I mean, one of the craziest parts of the Theranos scandal is that Walgreens essentially did not do any due diligence. It hired a laboratory consultant, as I explained in the book, Kevin Hunter, in 2010 to help it vet the technology. And Hunter flew out to Palo Alto twice with Walgreens executives and attempted to do some independent verification. But whenever he asked tough questions or asked to see the lab or asked to conduct a 50-patient comparison study at Stanford, Elizabeth Holmes would shut him down and say, no, we're actually not interested in doing that. And after a few months of Kevin Hunter asking tough questions, Elizabeth and Sonny, her boyfriend, told Walgreens that they didn't want him in meetings between the companies anymore, and they didn't want him participating in these weekly video conference calls anymore. And Walgreens actually agreed to exclude its own laboratory expert from the meetings from that point on. And so he was effectively, he continued to work for Walgreens for several months, but he was marginalized. He was excluded and prevented to do his job by his own, by the company that had hired him. It's one of the most extraordinary parts of the Theranos story.
The other thing it sounded like was that to show that they were getting results from just those little droplets of blood, in fact, they would dilute the blood.
Right.
And so several times to create more volume?
That came later. So fast forward to the fall of 2013, Theranos is going live in Walgreens stores with its fingerstick tests. Unfortunately, at that point, the latest iteration of its technology is a machine called the Mini Lab. And the Mini Lab is just a prototype that doesn't work. It's years from being ready to run patient samples. And so what Theranos does is it dusts off an older machine called the Edison, named after Thomas Edison, which is a limited machine because it only does one class of blood tests known as immunoassays. It's also, it doesn't do those tests very well. And so they roll out with the Edison for a handful of tests on the menu, and then for almost all the other tests, they use commercial machines made by the likes of Siemens, machines that any laboratory can buy off the shelf. But to uphold the myth that they can test tiny fingerstick samples, they hack those Siemens machines and they modify them to accommodate tiny samples of blood. And one of the ways they do that is by diluting the blood, because the Siemens machines are equipped to handle normal-sized samples drawn from the arm. And so they have to dilute the blood to create more volume so that the Siemens machine will actually accept the sample. And the problem with that is that the Siemens machines already had a dilution step in their protocol, so you're effectively now double diluting the blood. And so you're adulterating the sample more and creating more room for error.
Because you dilute it with what? With a saline?
It was saline, roughly a saline solution. And the problem also is that they were diluting the blood so much that the substances in the blood that they were trying, the concentration of the substances in the blood they're trying to measure fell to levels that were beneath the analytical measurement range that the FDA had approved for the machine. So it meant using these Siemens machines in the way that neither the manufacturer nor the FDA approved of.
So you're basically saying there was very little FDA-approved, potentially actual blood in the sample that could lend itself to a lot of errors in terms of readings.
Right.
Of what
the dilution was very problematic, and ultimately Theranos had to void or correct nearly a million blood test results in California, in Arizona. And I actually know from an ex-employee that the last lab director at Theranos was arguing to Elizabeth Holmes that they should void or correct every single blood test result ever returned to a patient, meaning almost 8 million blood test results, because he felt that the quality control had been so terrible that really they couldn't vouch for any of the blood test results they had returned to patients.
And how far did this go in terms of affecting patient health with these blood test results? There were some reports about people going to emergency rooms. Did anyone die?
You know, it's very difficult to know. There's patients who have banded together and sued Theranos for consumer fraud, and they're alleging medical battery. And one of them is alleging that a Theranos blood test, he had failed to detect his heart disease and that he went on to have a heart attack that was preventable. It's hard to prove this, and he'll have to try to prove this in court. I did come across more than a dozen examples of patients who had real health scares because of false blood test results, one of whom was a real estate agent, independent real estate agent in Arizona, whose doctor sent her to the emergency room in a rush the eve of Thanksgiving 2014 because she had received blood test results that were abnormal, and she had this symptom, which was a ringing in her ear. And so her doctor became concerned that she was on the cusp of a stroke. So she spent 4 hours in the hospital on the eve of Thanksgiving getting a battery of tests. And at the end of the visit, they retested her blood at the hospital. And all those results that had come back abnormal from Theranos came back normal from the hospital. Then she had another set of tests over the ensuing week. And finally, she and her doctor came to the conclusion that the Theranos results were inaccurate. But this is the type of way that patients' lives were affected by these inaccurate, unreliable blood test results.
We're talking with Wall Street Journal investigative reporter John Caribou about his book about the rise and fall of Theranos that promised to revolutionize blood testing as we know it. Much has been made about the CEO, Elizabeth Holmes. So how was she so beguiling that she could cover up all of these, you know, basically fake results, or she could put out all these fake results, cover up that she was doing it, and convince people to believe her? I mean, who is she?
I mean, she's very intelligent, very charismatic, did believe in her vision of these painless, user-friendly, fast test results. And I think in her mind, the ends justified the means. She overpromised every step of the way to investors, to partners, to the public, to the press. And it got to a point where her promises and her assertions about where she was with the technology, the gap between that and the reality became enormous. And it became so wide that, as the SEC itself called it, it became a massive fraud. When the company went live with its technology in Walgreens stores, the latest iteration of the technology just didn't work. And most of these blood tests were conducted on third-party machines. So that's what happened. I think this isn't a Madoff-type fraud in the sense that Madoff, sometime in the late 80s, decided to start cheating. And from then, it was just black and white cheating and a Ponzi scheme. I think Elizabeth Holmes dropped out of Stanford at 19 years old and really did want to become a successful entrepreneur and to build a device that did what she wanted it to do, and unfortunately ran into obstacles, as entrepreneurs often do, refused to acknowledge that these setbacks and started lying, and the lies got bigger and bigger. And I think in her own mind, the line between the lies and the reality must have blurred, and that's how we got to the situation where investors were defrauded and patients were put in harm's way.
You've also made quite a bit about an anecdote from when she was a kid, and they asked her what she wanted to be when she grows up. And she said a billionaire. And then somebody said, well, don't you want to be president? And she said, the president will want to marry me because I'm a billionaire.
Right.
Why was that such an important thing for you to include?
Well, the thing to know about the Holmes family history is that she is descended from the Fleischmann-Yeast dynasty. These Hungarian immigrant brothers came to America in the late 1800s, and created this very successful business called the Fleischmann-Yeast Company. And by the turn of the 20th century, the Fleischmann and then Holmes family were, you know, some of the richest people in America. And she grew up with tales of this incredible entrepreneurial success. Her father also reminded her of the failures of the later generations. His grandfather and father had squandered all that wealth. And so I think, these stories were very much present during her childhood and her upbringing. And she wanted to recover, the Holmes family's place in society, she wanted to recreate its success, and I think that's part of what explains this determination to become a very successful entrepreneur and to become a billionaire.
She must have also been incredibly charismatic. I mean, she put together a board that included Henry Kissinger and former Secretary of State George Shultz and investors like Jim Mattis, Betsy DeVos, Sam Walton of Walmart fame. I mean, that's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, I mean, the thing she did over and over again, starting when she was 19 years old, is she won the backing of someone who's older and with a great reputation. The first person who she got support from was Channing Robertson, her engineering school professor at Stanford, who had a great reputation, one of the
credibility
stars
on the
Absolutely.
Engineering side.
And he gave her credibility when she approached investors as a teenager. A couple years later, she met Donald L. Lucas, the VC who groomed Larry Ellison and helped him take Oracle Corporation public in the mid-1980s. And Lucas introduced him to all his friends in VC circles and, again, gave her more credibility. And so she leveraged that association.
And got Ellison, too.
Larry Ellison put money in Theranos as well. And then in the 2010-2011 period, Don Lucas started developing Alzheimer's disease. And she set her sights on George Shultz, whom she met at a a Stanford Medical School doctor. And George Shultz, as everyone knows, was the Secretary of State in the Reagan administration. Many people credit him with winning the Cold War. He's a revered figure to this day in Republican circles. And he's also very passionate about science, and he lives right off the Stanford campus. And when he met Elizabeth, he was really wowed by what she said her technology could do. Taken in by her mission and joined her board, and then proceeded to introduce her to all these other ex-statesmen, Henry Kissinger, Bill Frist, Sam Nunn, Bill Perry, who'd been Secretary of Defense under Clinton.
But as you point out, all people who didn't have backgrounds in biotechnology, really, or medicine.
Right. And I think a lot of people were impressed with that board, these larger-than-life personalities with fantastic resumes. But if you stop to think about it, none of them had any connection to medicine or knew anything about diagnostics or blood testing.
How did you start to get the sense that there was something fishy here, or there was just something not right?
Well, the first time I ever heard of Theranos was actually when I read a profile of Elizabeth Holmes in the New Yorker magazine in late 2014, December 2014. She had risen to fame in Silicon Valley about a year earlier, had graced the cover of Fortune magazine in June 2014. I think that's the magazine cover story that really vaulted her to stardom. I only learned about her through that profile in the New Yorker at the end of 2014. And one of the things that struck me as odd as I was reading the story on the subway on my way back from the office in Manhattan to Brooklyn, where I live, was that this notion that a 19-year-old college dropout had, with just two semesters of chemical engineering classes under her belt, had dropped out and proceeded to revolutionize, you know, blood testing and pioneered groundbreaking new medical science. I knew you could do that with computers, you know, with coding. Mark Zuckerberg, Bill Gates taught themselves how to code at an early age by just, you know, reading computer coding manuals and spending a lot of time at the keyboard. But you can't really do that in medicine. You know, medicine, you need the formal training. You need to do years, if not decades, of research. And most Nobels in medicine win their prizes in their 60s. There's a reason for that. So I thought that was odd, and it didn't sit well with me. But to be fair, I probably would not have done anything with it if I hadn't gotten a tip. And that tip came about a month later from a practicing clinical pathologist in the Midwest who moonlighted as the writer of this obscure blog called Pathology Blog, B-L-A-W-G is how he spelled it. And he had seen the New Yorker story too, and knowing a thing or two about blood testing, was immediately skeptical. And he wrote a skeptical blog item and then was immediately contacted by this little band of Theranos skeptics, one of whom had been involved in patent litigation against Elizabeth Holmes, and during that litigation had become convinced that Theranos was a scam. And it so happened that this guy, Richard Fuse, had just made contact with a former Theranos employee, a lab director at Theranos who had just left the company. So when I heard about this and I heard that there was a primary source out there that I might be able to make contact with and get real information from, then, you know, my ears pricked up and I pulled on that string until I got to the laboratory director.
Yes, so really just connection after connection. We're talking with Pulitzer Prize-winning Wall Street Journal investigative reporter John Carreyrou. His new book is Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup, and it's about the rise and fall of Theranos, which is a blood testing device company that promised essentially to transform the way that we draw and test blood. And Carreyrou was instrumental in revealing the fraud behind that claim. What do you want to ask him? He's here with us for the hour. The number to call is 866-733-6786. Again, 866-733-6786. You can also ask your questions on our website, kqed.org/forum. Email us at forum@kqed.org or post your comments on Facebook or Twitter. More after the break. I'm Mina Kim. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're joined by John Carreyrou of the Wall Street Journal, who in October of 2015 wrote an article exposing the troubling and deceptive business practices of Theranos, the blood testing startup many believed would upend healthcare. Carreyrou's story initiated the precipitous fall of the $9 billion company and in its enigmatic founder, Elizabeth Holmes, a Stanford dropout. And here she is the evening after that story, or evening of the publication of that October 2015 story, trying to explain what it exposed.
This is what happens when you work to change things. And first they think you're crazy, then they fight you, and then all of a sudden you change the world.
And here she is a couple days later at a Wall Street Journal conference addressing directly John Carreyrou.
Just because some guy reports false stuff about us doesn't mean that it changes our business.
Now, John Carreyrou, Elizabeth there has been some pushback from Theranos. There was even a 60 Minutes piece just recently that they responded to, where they basically said that that what is in that story was misleading and incomplete. And they say that in hindsight, they made progress, but just did not meet all of our expectations. You've also gotten some pushback from Tim Draper, who was one of the early investors in Theranos, who basically said that none of this is proven, all of this is innuendo, that, you know, that basically you're trying to take down an entity that is really trying to change the world in a very legitimate sense.
Yeah, I mean, Tim Draper's stance seems to be that just because Elizabeth had a bold vision that was interesting, that, you know, that excused wrongdoing and essentially white-collar crime. I don't think that being an entrepreneur with a bold vision means that you can ignore all the laws that every other citizen in our society has to abide by. What Elizabeth Holmes and her boyfriend Sonny Balwani did really is white-collar crime.
And Sonny Balwani was her number two and also her romantic partner at one time.
That's right. And they have both been charged with fraud by the SEC. The SEC, when it announced the fraud charges, called it a massive fraud, an elaborate years-long fraud. And I don't think Tim Draper has spent so much as a minute looking at those SEC fraud charges. Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos settled with the agency without admitting or denying wrongdoing. She paid a $500,000 penalty, relinquished most of her stock and voting control over the company, and agreed to a 10-year ban from being a director or officer in a public company. Sonny is still fighting the charges in civil court in California. A lot of people feel like that punishment, the SEC settlement, was really just a slap on the wrist and not commensurate with the magnitude of the misconduct. But people forget there's a second parallel investigation that's been going on for 2.5 years that's spearheaded by the U.S. Attorney's Office in San Francisco. And I think we should know in a matter of months the outcome of that investigation. And according to my sources, it's very advanced and drawing to a conclusion, and criminal charges are a distinct possibility.
Well, that answers a couple of questions from our listeners. Debbie tweets, Bad Blood is a thrilling, compelling read. That's the name of John Carreyrou's book, Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. She also writes, but Elizabeth Holmes' long con affected real people. How soon does John Carreyrou expect criminal charges to be filed? You said in a couple of months. Ron asks, will Elizabeth Holmes be indicted for fraud and potentially sent to jail? Are any other Theranos principals possibly being indicted? What do her advisors from Stanford say regarding her ethics and fraud? Do you have any insights into this?
Well, I think that the criminal investigation is targeting Elizabeth Holmes and Sonny principally. I think no one else interacted and interfaced directly with investors and made the promises and the false representations that the two of them made to investors. I think, you know, they were aided somewhat by Christian Holmes, her younger brother, and his fraternity brothers from Duke, you know, who participated in these bogus demos that they held for investors and board members. And they were also aided by an executive at the company named Daniel Young, who was sort of the trusted lieutenant that they relied on to implement, different for instance, he was the one who sort of was the mastermind behind the modification of the Siemens machines to adapt them to finger stick samples. So, you know, potentially the federal prosecutors could be looking at Christian and Daniel Young. But I think really the investigation is focused much more on the two people at the top who ran this fraud as really a partnership, Elizabeth and Sonny.
And you have a funny anecdote in your book about how the staff at Theranos realized how little knowledge both Elizabeth Holmes and Sonny Balwani had about chemistry, even calling the chemical sign for potassium P in a presentation,
right,
just to prove that he didn't know it was K, things like that.
Right. And I have a 14-year-old son who's a freshman in high school, and he's taking chemistry, and he does not make that mistake.
Well, let's hear from our listeners on the phone. Michael in Oakland. Hi, Michael.
Hi. You sort of addressed this early on in the show. At what point do you think that they sort of stopped drinking their own Kool-Aid, if they were? Like, presumably at the beginning, they probably thought they had a technology that would work if they could just get the bugs out, and they would fake it until they make it. Do you think it was cynical from the very beginning? Do you think there was a clear point where they realized that it was a fraud? Do you think they thought they could make it work up until the death of the company? Like, what's the story?
I think that the hubris, the conviction that they were working on something groundbreaking continued to be there really up until this day. I know from sources who were still working at the company just a few weeks ago that Elizabeth Holmes considers that she hasn't done anything wrong, that she feels persecuted, that if anyone is the bad guy, it's me for taking down this company. And so she and Sonny remain the whole time convinced that they were working on something game-changing. And I think their behavior and their attitude was always the ends justify the means. You know, we're going to get there eventually, and whatever it takes to get there, we can rationalize and justify in our minds.
Toward the end of the book, you raise the possibility that Holmes is a sociopath. I mean, you use that word. You say leave it to the psychologist to decide. Why did you feel the need to say that and not let the book speak for itself? And the other reason that I asked that is because Maureen, our listener, is asking, how psycho is she really?
So I've heard back from several psychologists who have read the book, and they've zeroed in on that question, and their answer has been yes. It's not a big study, but so far, you know, the anecdotal feedback from several psychologists is that that the symptoms are there. I would say that you know, my reporting throughout the book shows. I mean, the prologue, the opening scene in the book, is from November 2006, so just barely 3 years into the company's life. And the chief financial officer of the company then learns that these demos that they've been showing to investors and that they've been using to convince early investors to put money in are fake. And he confronts her in her office, and she turns icy, and she says to him, you know, you're not a team player. I think you should leave right now.
She fires him on the spot.
She fires him on the spot.
But it's always tricky territory to medicalize somebody, right? And yet you felt rather confident, I think, to be able to do that, to say that.
I spoke to between 150 and 200 people for the book, and I spoke to more than 60 ex-Theranos employees, many of whom worked with Elizabeth for years. It's no exaggeration to say that the consensus is that she lied again and again and again, and that she deceived people again and again and again.
Well, this listener asked a question about employees. So many PhD-level scientists and engineers must have worked at Theranos. How did they tolerate what seems to have been such a blatant fraud? You do write about the company culture.
Right.
And your anecdote actually is very revealing.
Yes, the company culture was one of fear, paranoia, and intimidation, secrecy. It started out that way even in the early years. Elizabeth didn't really tolerate dissent and fired people a lot, including the chief financial officer in late 2006. That culture really went into overdrive when Sonny joined the company in late 2009. At that point, Theranos had burned through the $47 million it had raised in its first three rounds of funding and was on the verge of bankruptcy. And Sonny, who had made money in the late 90s during the dot-com boom, personally guaranteed a line of credit that the company took out and Theranos was able to stay afloat thanks to that. And at that point, with skin in the game, he joined the company. He became the number two executive, and he really became the hatchet man. He took to firing people so often that a new expression was coined among Theranos employees, which was to disappear someone. When a colleague suddenly didn't show up at the office in the morning, they would say, Sonny disappeared him or disappeared her. And the turnover at Theranos is unbelievable. People were constantly getting fired, and people were also leaving of their own initiative because many had qualms with what was going on and couldn't rationalize in their minds staying there anymore. Now, why did all these people who were fired or who left of their own initiative, why did no one blow the whistle until very late in the game? I think it's because of this culture of intimidation. Elizabeth had sued ex-employees early on. She had sued Richard Fuse over the patent, so she was litigious. Everyone knew that. Sonny scared people, and the company's outside counsel was David Boies, one of the most famous and feared litigators in America. And I think
yes, he's of marriage equality fame, also of defending Gore in the Florida vote recount.
Right.
Very famous attorney.
Right. But his law firm, Boies Schiller Flexner, is also known for aggressive tactics. And
they were very aggressive with you
very
before
aggressive.
The publication
yeah.
of your October piece.
And so for employees, Boies was like a scarecrow. They worried that if they ever tried to blow the whistle to the media or to a regulator, that the company would come at them hard and David Boies would be leading the charge. And they were right to fear that because that's what happened.
And I find also the fact that Rupert Murdoch, right, of the Wall Street Journal, invested probably the biggest individual investor in Theranos.
Right. $125 million.
And so Elizabeth Holmes tried to pressure him to pressure the Wall Street Journal
to the extent that you can pressure Rupert Murdoch. But yes, she met with him several times before my story was published, once at Theranos headquarters in Palo Alto in July, a couple months before the story was published, and then one more time 2 weeks before the story was published in his own office on the 8th floor of the News Corp building in Midtown Manhattan. And I was on the 5th floor in the journal's
and
newsroom.
Couldn't get an interview with her.
I had been asking for an interview for 5 months and been getting threatened and stonewalled by
and
her lawyers.
Did you know she was a few floors
And I, di- I didn't even know she was in the building. Of course, I didn't know at the time. And I only learned about this a year later when I took a book leave and started reporting the book. But it was pretty stunning to find that out.
And we're talking with John Carreyrou, investigative reporter with The Wall Street Journal. His new book is Bad Blood, Secrets and Lies in a Silicon Valley Startup. A link to an excerpt of the book is available on our website, as well as a cartoon history that KQED did a little while ago. Let's go to Luis in San Francisco. Hi, Luis.
Hi there. I was wondering, I've read there's a very stringent federal process in place that certifies labs to test blood. And I guess my question is, A, how important was getting the certification to allow Theranos not only to conduct their internal activities, but also to market themselves to partners and investors? And B, how did they get this certification when other companies spend years and years and years trying to get the same certification and never do? I'll take no answer up there.
Thanks. And is it Lewis or Luis? I'm sorry, Oh, he's off the air. That's right. Well, thank you for that question. It's an important question because you also talk about how Theranos was able to take advantage of some loopholes.
Right. So the only federal certification that Theranos ever had was a CLIA certificate for its lab in California. And it got the first one in 2012. It's sort of a mystery how the company was able to obtain it. I think the lab at that point was brand new and They did have an experienced lab director who, like many other Theranos employees, didn't last very long. They had commercial equipment in there. I think it was a cursory lab inspection. They got their CLIA certificate. I think the key inspection that enabled the fraud to continue was the CLIA certificate renewal 2 years later. A state inspector came to the lab again and Theranos had divided its lab into two parts. There was one part upstairs, which was the CLIA lab, and then a part downstairs.
You mean the one that was federally approved?
Yeah.
Essentially.
And a part downstairs that was a research lab, and the part downstairs had the Edison machine that they did a few of the blood tests with, and then the hacked Siemens machine. And the state inspector was never shown that part of the lab downstairs, which they called Normandy because the conceit was that the Theranos technology would take the lab industry by storm, like American and British troops had in 1944 to liberate Europe. And the upstairs part was called Jurassic Park because it contained regular machines that were soon going to be made obsolete by Theranos technology. But the inspector was misled because the inspector thought that the lab was just the upstairs part with the unaltered, unmodified commercial machines, when in fact there was also the bottom part where they were also running patient samples. And so that was a big part of the deception.
Well, Michael asked, did Theranos ever file a patent application? And yes, they did. And they
Theranos filed a lot of patents. You know, my research about their patents is that it covers a lot of very incremental innovation. There's not much that's groundbreaking about the Theranos patents. Nevertheless, Fortress Investment Group, the New York private equity firm, saw enough value in those patents to lend the company $65 million last year to keep it afloat. And now that Theranos has almost burned through that money, Fortress is going to be seizing the Theranos assets and also will own going forward the Theranos patents and probably will use them to try to earn license fees from other diagnostic companies.
Well, Carrie says, I interviewed to be Elizabeth Holmes' executive assistant in 2013. My husband has a PhD in chemistry, and when I came home from the interview, obviously excited at the prospects of such a prestigious job, he was immediately skeptical. He spent the evening researching and knowing then that something seemed sketchy, hardly advised me against accepting the job. How many employees are left at Theranos right now? In their statement in response to the recent CBS 60 Minutes piece, they said that, you know, even at present, testing is now available in grocery stores and pharmaceutical chains. So
not by Theranos. I mean, one of the ironies of the Theranos scandal is that some of those clinics that were renovated in Safeway stores are now occupied by Quest. And that Quest, Sonora Quest, a joint venture of Quest with a hospital chain in Arizona, is offering blood tests directly to consumers. The vision of direct-to-consumer test offering was not a bad one. And presumably Quest is offering reliable blood tests to consumers. Theranos and Elizabeth Holmes are treading on very dangerous ground by pushing back against the CBS mm-hmm. 60 Minutes segment because there's a paragraph in the SEC complaint or in the SEC settlement that they can reopen the docket if she starts denying that fraud was committed. It was risky for them to try to rebut that CBS segment.
I'm sorry, you're putting the actual Theranos closing its doors at sometime this summer, right?
Right. So you asked me about how many people are left
yes.
at the company. Elizabeth laid off another 100 employees about 2 months ago and that same day sent an email to investors, first asking for more money and then explaining that if investors didn't pour in any more money, that the cash level of the company would go below $3 million by the end of July, at which point the loan covenants with Fortress would allow Fortress to seize the assets and liquidate them. So I think that's what's going to happen. By August, Theranos will be liquidated and will cease to be a going concern.
Well, Jen is skeptical of your narrative. She says, ask him why he's making up an embellished narrative and how many kickbacks he got from competitors.
Well, that is one of the lines that Elizabeth Holmes and Sonny, followed in the wake of my first story was that I was in league with Quest and LabCorp, that I was a puppet of the entrenched, laboratory duopoly. And I can tell you that's hogwash. I'm getting paid kickbacks by no one. The only money I make is my salary from the Wall Street Journal and the advance I got from my publisher for the book. I think the SEC has proven that my reporting was correct. And I think in coming months, federal prosecutors will also prove that my reporting was correct.
Well, let's go next to Kim in San Mateo. Hi, Kim.
Hi there. I just wanted to comment. I think this woman is being treated unfairly. First of all, she's a woman, and a powerful woman in tech, which makes her a target. She was on the advent of creating a laboratory data that was going to revolutionize healthcare and make laboratory work much cheaper for the consumer. And look, there were a series of missteps. I think the quality control was unconscionable. But I think what a lot of people don't realize is that there are a lot of medical devices that are on the market that are still being improved that are faulty, and no laboratory report, by the way, is perfect.
Kim, thanks. John Carreyrou.
I mean, I think that's a very generous interpretation of events. My book leaves no doubt that the company cheated when it went live with its blood tests. It had a 250-test menu, and at most 12 of those tests were done with proprietary Theranos technology, namely this Edison device that was faulty and unreliable. If you read the CMS lab inspection report, Theranos' own data shows that the Edison results were all over the map and completely unreliable. And then the other some 230 tests on the menu were done with commercial machines that any lab can buy from a diagnostic equipment maker. And to uphold the myth that they could do this supposedly breakthrough finger stick testing, they tried to modify those machines. And as we went over earlier in the show, the dilution part of the modification made the testing less accurate and put patients in harm's way. And I think that that all these things amount to wrongdoing. They amount to deception and they amount to fraud.
Well, Bob says, pay attention to the way that Holmes, Tim Draper, even people like George Shultz act as if they were just trying to change the world. This is about money, not saving the world or even making a useful product. Stop sanctifying snake oil salesmen. Carol asks, how would one stop the Theranos-style scams? Venture capital seems ripe for celebrity-studded pitches that have no real value. You do have some lessons, I think, for the Valley in terms of the story that you're telling, and also lessons for the media as well. Why don't you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think one of the biggest mistakes Elizabeth Holmes made is that she modeled herself after Steve Jobs and Apple and essentially took the traditional Silicon Valley tech industry as her model. And there's been a history of fake it until you make it in Silicon Valley, you know, going back a long time in the early 80s, a term called vaporware was coined to describe software that was announced with great fanfare by a company and then either never released or released, you know, years later without the features that had been promised. And that you know, Steve Jobs, Larry Ellison, at various times were accused of engaging in the practice, and it's kind of like part of the DNA of the Valley. You need to wow venture capitalists with your vision in order to convince them to put money in your company, and then once you have the money, you try to execute on your vision. The problem is that there's a big difference between what is essentially software development and medicine, Elizabeth Holmes lost sight of the fact or chose to deliberately ignore the fact that her product was a medical device. It was a blood testing machine that people relied on, that doctors and patients relied on to make important health decisions. And you can't engage in the practice of vaporware in the realm of medicine. And I think that's one of the big lessons of this Theranos scandal as increasingly medicine and tech converge. I think that's for sure a trend, and it's only going to intensify. And I think anyone involved in health tech should take stock of this story and hopefully learn a lesson from it.
Tech media also, it seems, failed to really ask the tough questions about Theranos, its model, its chemistry. But they were also dealing with the fact that, you know, if you write negatively about a company that's buzzing, if you want access to people, you can't always be so tough on them.
Right.
Do you think that there's a lesson there as well, or do you see any change coming from that?
I mean, I think one of the big problems is that the journalists who wrote about Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos didn't really have any background in medical reporting. The first publication that actually put Theranos on the map in September of 2013 was my own newspaper, The Wall Street Journal. Our editorial page did a friendly interview with her, and the writer took all her claims at face value. And she actually used that story and the fact that she had gone live with the tests in Walgreens stores to solicit more investment. And most of the nearly $1 billion that Theranos raised over its 15-year history actually came after that. And then there was a Wired magazine story. Arguably, Wired does a great job of covering the traditional Silicon Valley tech scene, but doesn't write as much about healthcare and medicine. And then the story that really vaulted her to stardom was the cover story in Fortune in June 2014. That was written by Roger Parloff, who was a legal correspondent for Fortune and who had no background in medicine or tech. And then Ken Auletta in The New Yorker in December 2014 is a great writer who's written a lot about media and tech, but has also not covered medicine. I think that was the big problem.
Well, certainly this Theranos story isn't over. Teresa asks whether Elizabeth Holmes is being singled out as different than most founders and CEOs who exhibit narcissism because she's a woman. This story is going to be a movie that where Holmes is going to be played by Jennifer Lawrence. So are you a consultant on that movie?
I am. In fact, and Vanessa Taylor was just hired to write the screenplay. She co-wrote The Shape of Water. And,
well, sounds like it'll be big. Yeah. John Kerry Rue, thank you. I'm Mina Kim.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of the Minetti Schremm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.